absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, it surely does. It is a Sunday morning, and normally you would hear the old crotchety voice of the ATM. Cha-ching, cha-ching. No, no, no. It's Mr. FSP. Welcome to the Master Plan, Sunday, 10 a.m., right here on blogtalkradio.com/VICHBK. You can always check anything out on this wonderful network, which is sponsored by FantasySportsbookAndCasino.com, where winners win and players play. So go there today to make some wagers, especially on the Super Bowl, and get paid. Over there at FantasySportsbookAndCasino.com, it's a one-point spread for the Broncos. It was a pick'em, but pretty much it still is a one-point spread. But anyway, on today's show, I am sitting in for the ATM, and his co-host, Reverend Fantasy, who's going to lay some scriptures down, is on the line. He and I are going to break down what the Super Bowl is going to look like later on today. Also, we're going to take a little time and discuss the UFC 169 fight card that happened last night. Without further ado, let me bring in the Reverend. I got to give him some interest music. I got to find some Southern Baptist piano playing interest music for the Reverend. What's going on, Rev?
Hey, we're working on a budget here, man. So once we upgrade, we get another 20,000 listeners, man. I'll upgrade my promo, and we'll get some nice church music playing. Get the gospel, spitting some gospel on this Sunday morning. What's going on out there this fine Sunday morning? I'm missing my co-host JT, but hey, I guess we'll rock out. You know, FSP will do.
Really, I'm just a surrogate, huh? And just to let you know, we have over 300,000 listeners. On a consistent basis, maybe not that much. We have 300,000 listeners. But anyway, dear Reverend, we're going to open up the scriptures for you. And let's talk a little bit about that UFC 169 card that took place last night in New Jersey. White across, pretty much. From MetLife Stadium. It was actually in Newark, New Jersey, but 169, it was okay card. What did you think?
I think overall the card wasn't bad. I mean, there was no upsets to me, but it was a solid card. They put on a decent showing. You know, me being the company's forefront man on UFC fights, I probably know the most about these kind of things. I break them down all the time. You know, people always want to see guts and glory and people getting knocked out, but, you know, champions do what they do normally in the UFC. They fought last night, and officially one new champion was defended his new belt that he just got crowned with. So kudos to Kenneth Blau.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about a few fights, and then we can go on, because actually I didn't like card that much, but it was worth watching. The thing, and I believe it was crowned fight of the night and knockout of the night, but Abel Trujillo and Jamie Varner. Now, Jamie Varner was dominating this fight. He was whooping up on Trujillo, and Trujillo was giving it back. It was a slugfest. It was a slugfest. These guys decided to stand up and fight. Even though Varner had Trujillo in, like, three very dangerous submissions, the black Brazilian fighter didn't tap, and he got out. And he was stunned. I mean, it looked like he was going out. It just looked like he was gone. All Varner had to do was connect with one, like, gut kick or hit right up on the ear or something, and he would have been out. In the midst of Varner's flurry, Cejudo comes around with a right cross or a haymaker right cross that sends Varner slinging to the ground face first, butt up in the air. And this guy, he goes stomping around the ring, blah, blah, blah. But when Joe Rogan interviewed him, he was like, well, because he asked him, how hurt were you? And the guy said, man, I was hurting in a mug and stuff like that. He was saying that Varner had really put it on him. But that's the beauty about UFC and combat sports in general. One punch, one kick, one move can end the night for you. You know, 7 minutes and 32 seconds of the opener were electrifying, where these guys, for two rounds, well, 1.5 rounds, they were gone. They were gone. They were just like, it was over. It was just like the best thing that could have happened for this card, because the following matches, they were okay. I didn't like them too much. As you said, Rev, most people want blood and guts and knockouts and stuff. And a lot of this stuff was technical. It was technical. Like the Leaner, Lanker and Bogakovic, a Russian, and I don't know what the other guy's from, so I can't pronounce the name anyway. They were okay. They were okay. The fight wasn't that good. It was a flyweight. 125 pounds, excuse me, 925. What is flyweight? Like what, 115?
Flyweight is that 125?
Yeah, okay. I thought so. All right, 125. These guys were putting each other in ankle locks and trying to submit each other. And it was a good fight. It was a good fight. But the Russian came out with the win because Lineker, that kid, he didn't look 125. That kid looked like he was 140, 150 pounds, and he was throwing body blows on the Russian, and it was affecting the Russian. Unfortunately, he just couldn't finish because the third round, I had it one round apiece going to the third round, and then the Russian just poured it on and just beat him up. In the third round, slammed them multiple times, had dominant position, stuff like that. Then you go to one of the co-main events, which I actually thought was a good match. Alistair Overeem versus Frank Mir. Now,
big names.
Overeem, yeah, some big names. Overeem, again, this was a 1-1 matchup going into the third round, in my opinion. But the cards shaped differently. The cards had Overeem winning on all three rounds. I had Frank winning the first round. He got stunned a little bit, and Overeem was retreating, and he got caught in a couple things, but he actually pulled out and, you know, dropped bombs on him. But in the third round, Alistair found a way to just dominate Frank, just dominate him.
Point all right, well. That match was a classic grappler versus striker, you know, matchup, which I think was a bad matchup for Frank Mir, you know. But kudos to my man Oscar Overeem. He showed some diversity in that fight. You know, he took it. He struck with him. He took him down a couple times, and so it was a good fight. And kudos to Frank Mir for hanging in there. He put on a, you know, he got beat on all scorecards, 27. He had a good showing. That's his third or fourth loss in a row now. So I thought the loser might be losing their job, but I think the issue with the UFC heavyweight division, you're only looking at 10 guys that are. They're worth anything anyway, and two of those guys fought last night. So I don't really think Dana White's going to give any pink slips out after that one.
Well, you know, Frank Mir is a former UFC 2-time champion. He's been with the company for quite some time. You know, Dana's loyal, but if you can't win, he's willing to let you go.
Right.
He's willing to let you go.
Especially if you get knocked out, if you start looking sloppy. Frank Mir, he didn't look sloppy last night. He put on a solid performance, and he just, you know, Alistair Overeem kind of imposed his will on him, and, you know, that happens in a fight. You know, you can't win them all, but that's why it's the UFC. It's the cream of the crop. So I don't believe that Daniel issued any pink slips out after that fight, for sure.
Yeah, you know, I think that you look at the body of work that the guys have, you know, and from there you go on and adjust, you know. I think it's plausible to say that Frank deserves at least one more fight in the UFC, but will it happen? I don't know. But then that leads us to main event, or Jose Aldo versus, excuse me, did I skip Jose Aldo already?
No, yeah, I spoke. That was the fight with Jose Aldo against Roberto Lamas.
Yeah. Lamas took him apart in the fourth round. I mean, I thought Lamas actually, in the fifth round, but the fourth round, you know, Jose slowed down. You know, this is it's his calling card, so to speak. He's fired for the first three, and then after that, it's done. You know, it's like, okay, well, I'm gonna hold on to my title, so I'm gonna, you know, do what I gotta do to hold on to my title.
That's a classic Jose Aldo fight. Get out early, dominate the first three rounds, and then he seems like he tanks out cardio wise. He tanks out in the fourth and fifth round of most of his fights, even though he'll be dominating someone. Sometimes he even gets 10-8 rounds on him in those first three. I mean, he did it against Frankie Edgar. He got out early and then hung on the last two rounds. He did it in a lot of his fights. And Jose Aldo, some will say, argue is the best pound for pound. I mean, the guy, he's a stud. He just comes in and he imposes his will on you. And he reminds me of a 145 version of GSP, because he just comes in, he grounds and pounds you. He's very technical as far as striking. You don't get to see his jiu-jitsu aspect a lot of time because his leg kicks are so devastating. Usually he just takes his opponent's legs out from under him in the first, you know, two rounds, and most fighters are struggling from that point on to even keep their legs from, you know, collapsing. So, yeah, I mean, it was a classic Jose Aldo fight. Get out early, first three rounds, and then pack it up and cruise in, you know, and get a decision. So, Jose Aldo is going to start needing to start, like I said. So, he's going to need to start showing people who are going to, fans are going to want to start seeing knockouts. They're not going to want to see these five-round, you know, domination for three rounds and then just cruise the last two. But we've already seen that, and fans started getting tired of GSP after not eight or nine fights.
Well, that's the thing, you know. The stiffer the competition is for the champion, the harder it is to knock somebody out. But I think you're 100% right on his gas tank. His cardio, he comes into the octagon looking very sweet, very good. But he does waste his energy in those first three rounds. If someone can weather the storm for three rounds and, you know, totally dominate him for two, they could probably get a knockout. Or if they try to choke him out or something like that because he's so winded, you know, that might be an option. But the official scorecard was 49-46. And I understand, you know, the champ, in order to be the champ, you got to beat the champ. You know, But again, that was a fight that I didn't really find too interesting. It was okay. It was okay, but it wasn't a very good fight in my opinion. And then the final fight, which was Barao versus Uriah Faber. Again, a fight that I thought it was going to be a lot more than what it was. I really did. Again, Faber gets punched in the face. He then goes down, grabs on to Barao's ankle and covers up. And it might not have been the quote-unquote intelligent way to defend yourself, but I thought, you know, he gave a good performance. He gave a good performance, and I don't think the ref should have stopped it. Just like the ref didn't stop Frank Mir when Overeem was whooping up on him, in the first round, and Mir ended up getting up and making a fight out of it, that the ref should have let Uriah do the same thing. Get up, find a way to get up, find a way to defend a little more, and if he was going to get knocked out, let him get knocked out. I mean, you got to protect him,
right.
Yeah, but I just thought he stopped it too quickly. What do you think?
I agree. My argument with the UFC is, you know, sometimes some refs are cool. They'll let a fighter weather the storm. Other refs, they jump in first sign of smoke. They're quick to jump in and protect their product. You know, like I said, UFC's really, their referees are really good about protecting the fighters, almost to the point where they forget sometimes it's a fight. You know, let the guy take some for a little bit because he might still be able to come out of it and turn the fight around. I was a little disappointed with Uriah's performance. You know, Temple out of animal, the guy ain't lost in 9.5 years. People don't really know how good Kenneth Brow is. This guy he's a real deal. I mean, you don't not lose a fight for 9.5 years. And it ain't like he's fighting once a year, you know. This guy's fighting 2 to 4 times a year for the last 9 years, and he's lined them up and he slayed them anywhere from, he's fought from 135 up to 155. So, I mean, yeah, this guy, he's a complete package, man. When I watch him fight, he's an exciting fighter. He's got all-around game. He can take it to the ground, his jiu-jitsu. And the guy's pretty massive for fighting at 135. Same thing with Uriah Faber. Them guys are thick, man. They look like on fight night, they're packing it in like in the 170s to me. And, from a Fight X standpoint, I was really disappointed with Uriah just because Uriah's been around, you know, he's been the face of MMA for most, places he's fought. He's won belts. I just don't see him getting another title shot in the UFC because this is his third he's already had, and he's 0-3. And UFC is really good about that. Once you get about that third one, man, and you don't cash in, you might find yourself on the outside looking in. Problem is with Uriah, he's so good that he's going to be probably the number two or number three contender at 135, 145 for the next couple of years. The guy's still an animal, so there's no disputing that. Problem is, mainly he gets those feature fights against the champ. He doesn't cash in, and honestly, he just did not have a good performance last night. So I just think his days of getting a title fight are probably done.
Well, I think Uriah, because of who he is, the notoriety that he brings, and his abilities, you know, there's a great chance that he'll get another title shot because who's in that weight class other than Dominic, who's going to be out for some time, that can come in here, give you the star power that he brings.
I mean, that's the thing he has going for him. Even though those divisions at 135 to 145, there's a lot of guys that fight, and they're solid. They got balance. They got a lot of fighters who are solid. They don't have that name getter, you know. Even a guy like Kenneth Corral, on the national fight scene, a lot of people, until UFC promoted him saying, this guy ain't lost for 9.5 years, you wouldn't have known that. You wouldn't have known that. So, and then guy that lined up behind him, there isn't a whole lot, you know, out there that name-wise, you know. So, and unless you're a guy who is really in the fight game, I studied a fight game, and, you know, only people that are lined up behind him, you know, that comes to my mind is a guy like Chad Mendez, who was calling the fights on Fox last night. He's a guy at 145, but even those guys, they've already had their title shots and have lost. So, you know, UFC's really good. Usually they don't do trilogies too much, and now Kenneth Brown beating Uriah twice. They might give him a third shot. Just like we said, he's good enough to clean out the division to deserve a third shot. I just don't know if he'll get that.
Agreed. I want to move on to a new topic that we haven't talked about in the past. That was that was UFC 169. In a nutshell, the prelims were pretty good. So I think the UFC needs to find a couple new stars. You know, there's talk that pro wrestler CM Punk is going to come into the UFC and Brock Lesnar is going to get another shot at the UFC sometime soon and all this other mess. So we'll see whatever it is that they're going to do in order to, bolster their lineup and their fan base, they'll have to do it. But I want to move on to another big event that took place last night, and it happened at the NFL Honors. One thing I'm going to say is this. I think that the voters got something wrong when Kiko Alonso did not win Defensive Rookie of the Year. Kiko Alonso almost had 200 tackles. He had a couple interceptions. I think he had like 5 or 6 sacks. But the Jets linebacker got Rookie of the Year, Defensive Rookie of the Year, with like 78 tackles and 3.5 sacks. That was horrendous in my opinion. But hey, it is what it is.
I didn't agree with a couple of the votes yesterday, but we can dive into that real quick.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just want to talk about that one aspect before I went to the Hall of Fame inductees. But if you have more on
I'm not a big fan of, like, how Peyton Manning. I get it hands down with the one guy who didn't vote for Peyton Manning is an idiot, you know, to vote for Tom Brady. I mean, I don't get how 49 out of 50 vote Peyton Manning and one guy. That just tells me it's like all the voting process. It's very subjective to regions, you know. And then
I agree.
The offensive player of the year, even though Peyton Manning, I don't agree he gets a double dip on that one. You know, I thought it should have went to Jamal Charles, personally. That's just my piece of the pie, I thought. And just like you said, yeah, I totally agree with you. Kiko Alonso should have won defensive rookie of the year. Luke Kuechly, I think we're looking at something serious. This guy could be, he might be able to run with it for the next couple of years. This guy's an animal. So, but I just wanted to add that in there. I just think Jamal Charles kind of got the short end of the stick yesterday, along with Kiko Alonso.
Agreed. Now, to the big boys, the Hall of Fame. I saw a couple of snubs, but then one of the big three finally made it in. I'm talking about Mr. Reed. But let me go down this list real quick for those that don't know. a guy who deserves being in the Hall of Fame. I didn't think he deserved on this opportunity. So Michael Strahan, Andre Reed, Walter Jones, Derek Brooks, and in the shot, to me, Aeneas Williams. Then you have the old-timers, Claude Humphrey and Ray Guy. Those are your newest Hall of Fame inductees. I think that it was a bit of a shocker that Aeneas got in and Bettis didn't, or Michael Strahan got in and Charles Haley still is not in the Hall of Fame. I don't know if they're trying to punish Charles or what, but those are your Hall of Famers.
It seems like they went with the throwback class this year. I totally disagree. I don't. For one, don't get me wrong. All those guys are deserving to be in the Hall of Fame. They all deserve it. But to throw, yeah, it's kind of a slap in the face to throw in Michael Strahan when Charles Haley, a guy who laid the foundation for a guy like Michael Strahan and has better numbers, I do believe, than Michael Strahan.
More Super Bowls, more impactful on several teams.
Definitely he should have got more recognition than Michael Strahan. I really thought when the initial list, or the pre-ballot, the initial ballot came out, not the finalists. I mean the finalists, but not the people that got selected. I thought Michael Strahan had no shot. Honestly, when I looked at it, I was like, there's no way. And I'm not taking anything against Walter Jones. He was a great, tackle when he played. But how do you put Andre Reed in, and you got arguably two better receivers in NFL history than him that didn't make the cut? Marvin Harrison. I mean, dude, Marvin Harrison was an all-pro for every year he played. And then to with way better numbers. And I know the Hall of Fame is a numbers-based game, which even makes the argument even more sillier because his numbers are 100 times better than Andre Reed. And it seemed like they just gave him a sympathy, vote. Oh, man, we didn't get him in. And how is Tim Brown not in over Andre Reed, who has better numbers also? I think, I laugh when I hear people say that the Raiders, the NFL hates the Raiders. I'm starting to believe that the NFL really don't like the Raiders. I think there's something there might be a little where there's smoke, there's fire out behind that. I'm starting to believe that because those two guys honestly got the biggest snubs to me. I thought, like I said, all those guys deserved it, but I thought for sure this year, Tim Brown, and I thought first-term ballot Hall of Famer was Marvin Harrison. Aeneas Williams, like I said, he was a great guy. Did he change the game when he played? That's debatable. He was, don't get me wrong, a solid pro for like 13 years, 14 years with multiple teams. He was a great player at his position. But, I mean, when you think of Tim Brown or you think of Marvin Harrison, and you put him against Aeneas Williams or Michael Strahan, just name recognition. To me, a true football player is going to go hands down Tim Brown and freaking Marvin Harrison. I'd rather have them. Or if you asked Andre Reed compared to those two guys, they're going to go with the other two guys straight up. So I don't know what your thoughts are. But
I think that, unfortunately, Tim Brown's going to be the new Andre Reed. I think he's going to be the guy that stays on the list for a long time and gets in finally at the very end of his eligibility. The reason why I say that is because you've got players coming out next year. You got other big name players, Torrey Holt, people like that who were better than Tim Brown. And you still got Marvin Harrison there. So,
right.
Unfortunately, I think Tim's going to be on that list for a while, and I think they put Andre Reed in there just because they know that with this new class coming up, he's not going to stand a chance.
Especially at the receiver position, because now that the league's up, I mean, don't get me wrong, like we talked about, Andre Reed's numbers were great. They weren't dominant, but they were great because he was in an era where he was on a team that didn't even throw it that much. You know, they were a primary run team, you know. And so what he did was truly great. But, I mean, the future of at the receiver position coming up over the next couple of years in Hall of Fame balloting is going to be out of this world because you're going to have these guys that were in that generation now that were throwing it 40, 50, 60 times a game. So their numbers are going to be through the roof. You know,
I agree. Well, I will say that Andre Reed was in a system that, you know, was past happy. I wouldn't say it was run first. Yes, Thurman Thomas was a big catalyst for them, but I don't think they were run first. They were.
Kelly wasn't swinging it 50 times a game. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, they were throwing like 30, 35.
Yeah, they were a balanced team, you know, straight eight. They kind of are the guy that really set the tone for the screen pass because Thurman Thomas was a screen pass, you know, first
mm-hmm.
kind of running back you could think that was a real screen pass option guy where he could kill you running for 1,000 and also get a 1,000 probably through the air also.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right about that. You're right about that. The one thing that I want to talk about in this class before we move on to the Super Bowl is Tony Dungy and Eddie DeBartolo not getting put in. I really think that I like Ray Guy, punter, Claude Humphreys, old-timers getting in. Got it. Love it. But I think they should have put Tony Dungy for his efforts in Tampa Bay as well as in Indianapolis in the Hall of Fame along with Eddie DeBartolo. Eddie DeBartolo, regardless of his indiscretions, you know, off the field as far as being an owner, he took care of his players. He won 3 Super Bowls. He helped shape the way the NFL is right now. And another guy that didn't even make it to the final round of 15 was Art Modell. You know, another pioneer in the NFL. So those 3 individuals, I think they should have been at least in this class. That's just my opinion. I think that Tony Dungy was a excellent defensive coordinator. Okay player, but fantastic head coach because he treated his players like men. Yes, he only went to 1 Super Bowl, and he only won 1 Super Bowl, but he saw success wherever he went.
You know what, Victor? Let me tell you. I agree with you, man. I really think that those guys should have got in. I don't know about – I really agree with you about right on this ballot. This ballot, like I said, was kind of – it looked like it was kind of like a throwback. Like, we're going to pick up the guys that we haven't picked up in the – you know, it's kind of like a trash ballot. We're going to pick up, you know, some of the old-timers that have been on this list. You know, they kind of threw a bone to those old guys. But, yeah, Eddie DeBartolo, guy was a great owner, great executive. And as a kid, I grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, and his offices on my way to church. I used to go by his offices, and they had the Super Bowl trophies out there. And you can see him in the window. And so I knew a lot Eddie DeBartolo. He's a Youngstown, Ohio guy. So he had a great career. I totally agree with you on that. Tony Dungy, I don't really agree with you. Great coach, don't get me wrong. Great man. I totally respect the guy. But I think the one black mark he has against him is his playoff record. If you look at his playoff record, he's like 9-10. I'm not sure if that gets it done to be on the ballot, you know, to be a first-term Hall of Famer, ballot Hall of Famer. That was just my opinion. I thought that was the only thing that that was going to hold him back, and that might have been the one thing that held him back.
I mean, yeah, you know, you're right. There's a lot of stuff that
maybe if he won multiple championships, then we're talking, you know, we're talking big things. But I mean, he only got one championship as Super Bowl as a coach, right?
Yeah.
With Tampa. So, I mean,
yeah.
9-10 playoff record, I just don't see that as, you know, above and beyond being,
well,
like I said, great guy. I just think maybe his, you know, people are overstating his importance a little too much, you know what I mean? But he's a great dude and a great coach, and I think he deserves it. I just don't know if he deserved it right on this card.
Well, the thing I was going to say about that is I know John Gruden won the Super Bowl with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, but Tony Dungy constructed that team to win the Super Bowl, and they went to the playoffs and championship game several times with Tony Dungy. I mean, this is like...
No, you're right. That's really... Unfortunately, he don't get credit for that, but yeah. Really, that was his second championship, but... Hey, yeah.
Well, here's my last question before we get to the Super Bowl. We got like 20 minutes left of live air. Is if a coach like Andy Reid is considered a very good coach, been to the Super Bowl one time, been to the conference title game six times, went to a new team, took that team to the playoffs, would Andy Reid be considered a Hall of Famer once he finished coaching, in your opinion?
I still think that the jury's out on that one, depending on what his future endeavors are. I mean, but if you were to say right now, today, I mean, that's a rough one, man. I mean, those six conference championship games, I mean, that speaks volumes because he was right on the cusp of, you know, even if half of those go his way and he's in the Super Bowl, we're looking at, you know, looking at something serious. I mean, Marv Levy, you know, I kind of compare it to Marv Levy, except Marv Levy made it to those Super Bowls, constructed those teams to make the Super Bowl. So, I don't know, man. That's a tough one. Well, that's a tough one to call, man. I mean, I still think it depends on what he does in his future. Honestly, that's to answer your question. I think it just depends how things play out in KC with him.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's move on to the Super Bowl. And the Super Bowl has two great teams. It has the Seattle Seahawks and the Denver Broncos. Before we get into the position play-by-play here, I know you have a personal issue with the Seahawks because you like to call them sea chickens. And you probably want the 49ers to win. I'm going to let you decide.
Let me tell you something, man.
If I was betting online,
what's our website again? Can you tell the fans out there? Hey, Victor?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. I guess. Yeah,
okay.
I think the Seattle
fans—they were
jamming my phone.
Go to fantasysportsbookandcasino.com where winners win and players play. That's it,
exactly.
Right there.
So if I was to go there and place a bet, if I was an odds maker, I do believe Denver's favorite by a point. To me, this is a pick 'em. To me. Honestly, you know, I don't like them sea chickens. I don't like them. I can't stand a sea chicken. This is truly a pick'em game for me. I'm still going to go with Peyton Manning just because I want to see Peyton Manning get that second one. So that's what I'm rolling with today. I'm going to roll with Peyton Manning. But I really think, real quick, I don't want to talk a lot about the game, but break it down. We're going to break it down here in a minute. I really just think it all hinges on Seattle's offense this game. That's all I'm going to say. But go Denver.
Okay, let's start with the offensive line, defensive line. Okay, we're going to start with Denver's defensive line versus Seattle's offensive line. The big matchup everybody's talking about is Max Unger, the center for the Seattle Seahawks, versus Pat Rose, Nightington, the defensive tackle for the Denver Broncos. By the way, Nightington is a backup who took the starting job from Vickers because he's more of a run stuffer. So break down the offensive line of the Seahawks versus the defensive line of the Denver Broncos, Rev.
Well, like we just talked about, you identified probably two key players in that matchup with Unger and Knightley. I'm going to call on this matchup, who's got the advantage in this. I'm honestly going to – it's hard because the D-line for Denver is a hit-or-miss defense in just in general, so not even just their defensive line. So it's a tough one to call. I'm going to call this one a push. I'm kind of leaning towards Seattle, but I don't know, man. I'm going to call this a push, man. Who's got the advantage? I'm going to call it a push.
Okay. Next level, because I think it's somewhat of a push as well, but you never know. But here's where I think there's going to be a big difference. I want to see the linebacking core of the Denver Broncos take on Michael Robinson and Marshawn Lynch. Paris Lennon, who took the place of Wesley Woodyard, is that guy. Give me that breakdown real quick.
Don't get me wrong. I like the matchups for Denver's linebackers have been playing great, especially in the playoffs. They've definitely have shown something. But I'm going advantage beast mode, and I'm going advantage Michael Robinson. The guy is a phenomenal fullback. And I think their line is going to hang in there just enough. And I just don't believe Denver's defense is going to be over. I'm going to go ahead and let the cat out of the bag, who I think is going to be my MVP of the game. More than likely, it has the best chance of being the MVP of the game, and that's beast mode. So he's not going to get there by himself. It's going to have to be Michael Robinson leading the way for him.
I can agree with that. I mean, I don't think he's going to be the MVP of the game, but I think he'll be a big part of it. Like my cousin was saying yesterday, if Marshawn Lynch gets 85 yards, he thinks the game is over. I disagree.
He's got to get in triple digits. He's got to run for over 130 plus in this game for them to win. Easy.
Well, you know, in the three or four losses, I think they lost three. I think Seattle's 13-3. The beast mode. He got 85 or 80-some-odd yards every time, and they still lost. And they lost because the teams spread them out. The teams worked them. The teams did some stuff to them that showed that, okay, well, you know what? You want to run the ball? You can't run the ball when you're down 20-something points. You can't do that. And if you do it, we're going to make you take time off the clock. You take time off the clock, you get a score, that's fine. But we're going to take the ball, go down and get some type of points. And I think that's where Peyton Manning and the Broncos are. Notoriously, the Seahawks have been slow starters the first half of the game. They come out the second half and they ball out. They're just not
right.
Good the first half of the game.
I.e. the Niners game in the championship, first play of the game.
Yeah.
Russell Wilson gets sacked and fumbled the ball.
You know, and they scored on a couple of those plays versus the 49ers on some, okay, well, false starts with a bomb for a touchdown. Then there was another fluke play that they got a lot of – oh, it wasn't fluke. Russell Wilson made it happen. He was running around, And
Baldwin, yeah. He scrambled around for like 20 yards and then he threw it deep.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't think that happens this game. But that's that level. Let's go to the DBs of the Broncos versus the wide receivers of the Seahawks. Now, it's very important that Percy Harvin plays this game, and, of course, he is playing, thanks to Pete Carroll and Harvin's health. I think it's essential that he plays the entire game so that Marshawn Lynch will have that run space. The reason why I say that is because he is their only serious person that can run down the field and create space. He's a physical player. You can line him up in the backfield as well and get him the ball. And special teams-wise, he can do some things to you. When you take him out of the equation, Doug Baldwin doesn't scare me. And I got Champ Bailey. The old Champ Bailey, which is right now, can still take care of Doug Baldwin.
I disagree. I disagree with that.
Okay. Well, you got Doug Baldwin on the other side. I mean, not Doug. Yeah, you got Doug Baldwin and Curse on the other side, where Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie can take care of one of them. So my advantage goes toward Denver's secondary. Even though they're not the best secondary, the advantage I see goes towards them. Go ahead, Rez. Speak on.
I'm going to go the complete opposite way. I'm going advantage Seattle receivers, even though – not one of the receivers scare me. Let's throw this out there. They're not one of them are bona fide great. Even Percy Harvin and all his greatness, what he did in Minnesota, he's not the same player right now. Right now. I think he's on the verge of one hit, and he'll, like, the Niners game, I mean, not the Niners game, the game prior against the Saints, first hit, and he could be out of the game. Some would like you to believe he could be an unsung hero this game in the special teams game, or he's such a threat to break it at any point, which is all true. I'm going to throw another sleeper out there. I think this guy, I don't think he's great, but the Super Bowl MVP always is usually a guy that's a nobody. Let's throw it out there like that. You know, Larry Brown back in the day. Who else? Desmond Howard. You can name multiple people that just weren't big-time pros and they showed up on the big stage. You know what I mean?
Yep.
I'm going to say Doug Baldwin, that guy. I think Doug Baldwin, he showed against the Niners. They blanketed him the whole game. He could never get away. But when Russell starts to get loose and scrambling around running, that guy gets open. And I think in the just of that happening, I think that's going to happen a lot in this game. I think that his numbers are going to add up because he usually gets – he doesn't catch a lot of balls, but when he catches balls, he's catching for 30 yards, 40 yards, 20 yards. And I, like I said, I'm not a big fan of anything defensively that Denver does. And even though they showed something against Tom Brady and those guys last 2 weeks ago, I'm not riding that train. And so I just think a guy like Doug Baldwin, I think, could be this an unsung hero this game and possibly end up winning the MVP. So mark my word, if he wins the MVP, you're buying lunch for a week.
No, I'm not. But we can make some type of arrangement later on, fool. But all right, let's flip it over now. Let's go that 49ers. The Seahawks defensive line versus the Denver Broncos offensive line. Now, you got Cliff Averill, Chris Clemons, Bruce Irvin, Mebane, Bennett, and a few other guys on that defensive front, which are very, very talented. However, Mebane and someone else comes out in passing situations. But the edge is crazy critical in this game, because that's where Peyton has his trouble. We have a outstanding pass rushing defensive end, and you have that in this game. So I give the advantage to Seattle's front, unless they spread out Seattle. If they spread out Seattle and take a couple of their big players out of the picture, I think the advantage goes to the the Broncos' offensive line, because they're keeping Peyton clean. They're keeping him clean. But let's see how they do against Averill, Irvin, and Chris Clements. Your take.
I definitely agree with everything you just said. I still go Venice, yeah, defensive line for Seattle. Too much talent. I think this is where the game is going to be decided also. Peyton Manning never gets touched. And regardless, when he is in the pocket, he's only back there for 3 seconds, and the ball's out. So, honestly, I don't really think it matters too much in the grand scheme of things. But I think in this game specifically, I don't think Peyton's going to be able to get that ball off in 3 seconds every time. And I think there's going to be time where he's going to have to hold on to it for 4 seconds, 5 seconds. And when that happens, they have to get him with that front four. They got to, or this game will be lost. Because there's no defense that can cover for a long period of time. You know what I'm saying? And don't get me wrong, the LOB is good, but Peyton Manning's better. You get what I'm saying? So I just think that front four is going to have to get on Peyton Manning somehow this game. And with Denver offensive line, I mean, like I said, I'm not a big fan of their run-blocking scheme. You know, no Sean Marino did some things this year. It's all predicated off the passing game. So I'm still going in as defensive line for Seattle. They've got to show up today. They're going to have to at least get 5 to 6 sacks, which is going to be a tough task because, like I said, Peyton Manning's going to – he gets the ball out so fast. But when those moments occur where he does hang on to it for 4 or 5 seconds, they got to get to him, no doubt.
Okay. Then let's move on to the linebacking core of Seattle versus the two-headed running attack of Denver. You got Monty Ball and you got No'Shawn Marino. No'Shawn Marino's dealing with some rib injuries. He's going to be in and out. So you got a rookie, Monty Ball, who's been stepping up lately, going against Bobby Wagner and that linebacking core. How do you see that playing out?
I go advantage Seattle. Even though No'Shawn Marino had a monster year this year, even Monty Ball had a solid rookie year, I just don't like the matchup against. Their running style is not a grind them, you know, running style. It's kind of a finesse running style. And they just don't play well against that linebacking core. That linebacking core, they fly around the field. And they might not have no big names, but they're all four of them are solid. And they cover well. So you can use those guys in a variety of ways. So the screen passes. And prime example of how solid their linebacking core is for Seattle was the last play in the championship game against the 49ers. Richard Sherman makes a great play, but the outside linebacker, Wright, I think is his name, he's 20 yards downfield trailing the play on that. Normally, a linebacker is not going to trail that. But that's just evident how their defense plays. He trails it and gets the tip, and they're in the Super Bowl. So I just think their linebacking core is too strong for Seattle. I give advantage Seattle all the way.
Okay. I can agree with you to a point, but I'm not going to get too much into it because I know you're short on time. Let's move on to an area that everybody is giving the advantage to Seattle except for me. I'm not giving Seattle the advantage in the secondary versus receivers. I truly think once you spread Seattle out thin, that they can't cover all of Manning's weapons. Not to mention when they bring Caldwell in. You go four wide receivers and Julius Thomas, or four wide receivers and a running back. They don't have the weapons, in my opinion. Four wide receivers. Or they go five wide receivers for that matter. You know, I just think that if you lock down one, you're not going to be able to lock down the other three or other four. It's just not going to happen. When you put Cam Chancellor in man-to-man coverage, he's okay, but he's not as fast as Julius Thomas. So he's not going to be able to cover him. Demaryius Thomas, he and Richard Sherman, okay, that's a wash. But Demaryius has been silent in a couple games, and the Broncos have won. Wes Welker on a linebacker or Wes Welker on the nickel cornerback, advantage Wes Welker, in my opinion. Then you got Maxwell, who's played very well, very, very well, against Decker. I don't think that's an advantage for the Seahawks. I think it's an advantage for the Broncos because Decker's a big, rangy guy that can also beat you down the field. And when Seattle plays a cover three defense, cause that's their go-to coverage when they match up man-to-man, it's cover three, Peyton's going to pick them apart with Welker and Thomas down the seams and stuff like that. So that's what I see happening. I give the advantage to the Broncos. Your take.
I'm going to go with you on this one. I'm going to agree. I give advantage to the Broncos. I mean, their receivers are too good, man. You could take Demaryius Thomas and put him on another team. He's going to be a number one. You could put Eric Decker on another team. He's going to be a number one. Wes Walker was a number one. Julius Thomas, you know, top three tight end in the league, you know. And so, yeah, I'm going definitely Denver receivers in this one. I think this game, it's, you know, the passing game is a very complicated thing for Denver. They like to run those pick plays. They like to get short passes, you know, quick slants to Demaryius Thomas who breaks them, underneath stuff to Wes Walker. It's going to be difficult this game, honestly. I think for Seattle's defense, like I said, they get up in your face and they jam you at the line. So that's where, like I talked about, they're going to have to definitely do that today. They're going to have to cover. But that's still going to come back down to that front four. They're going to have to get some kind of pressure because if the LOB can come up and play big on those receivers and jam them and cover them, for that first 3 seconds, that's going to make Peyton hang on to that ball a couple seconds, you know. And if Peyton hangs on to it, it could go two ways. It could go if their O-line protects them. Like I said, Peyton's going to make the connection. There's no doubt because no one can cover nobody, those receivers for 5-7 seconds. It just ain't going to happen. But if they're able to freaking jam those guys up at the line, the defensive backs for Seattle, and jam those guys up and hold them up for that first 3 seconds and make Peyton hang on to that ball, and then if that front four can get a good make them get happy feet, you've seen Peyton Manning do some questionable things in the playoffs. You know what I mean? Even in the Super Bowl, with Tracy Porter picking him off, costing that game when he played against the Saints. So I'm still going to go advantage Denver in this one with the receivers, but I mean that's a pick 'em pretty close. And I another guy I think if Seattle, I got four names that are on a short list of MVP candidates. I think Earl Thomas is another guy on defense we could be talking about if Seattle wins this game. That could be the MVP of the game.
Okay, I mean I can see that too. About to run out of time here. I know you got to go, but ladies and gentlemen, this is Fantasy Sports and Politics Production. It is the Master Plan. Normally, it's hosted by the Rev Fantasy. We're giving you our Super Bowl picks. And bottom line, I think the Broncos are going to win. I think it's going to be a very good game. But with the weather being what it's going to be, Denver-like atmosphere out there, Peyton Manning's going to throw all over the place and win the game. Bottom line, he goes out on top just like Ray Ray. He might come back next year. If he does, I'm picking everybody in Denver in fantasy football. If he doesn't, I got to say Brock Osweiler does in the preseason. With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, come back next Sunday, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, on the Master Plan. I'll be sitting in again for JTATM. Oh, no, we will not, because we will be at work, Mr. Rev, or will you still be where you are? You are. You're going to have to host the show. Will you be back?
I would like to be co-hosting, but we'll see.
All right, because if you're not back, then you'll be hosting. We'll see what happens, because I'll be at work. Anyway, every Sunday, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, JTATM Money and the Rev are right here doing the Master Plan. Then on Thursdays, FSP Crew Show with Jeff Black and Jerry doing what they do, holding it down. We had Daryl Too Sweet Cooley on this past week, and he gave us an earful about the Floyd Mayweather and boxing. You might want to check that out in the archives. That's p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Thursday. Then on Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Mac Williams, a.k.a. TM Money, with No Chaser. This week coming up, they've got street ball legend Baby Shaq. Baby Shaq coming on the show this Friday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Then again, on Saturday, you're right back here with me. It's me, Mr. FSP, doing what we do to do it for you. Saturdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All of these shows, all of them, are brought to you by FantasySportsBookAndCasino.com, where winners win and players play. So go there today. Place your wagers, Place your wagers.
I'm going to place mine right now.
You better, homie. You better. Anything you want to say before we get out of here, Rez?
Hey, man. Everybody have a good Super Bowl out there. Be safe and go Broncos.
All right. Everybody enjoy the Super Bowl. As of right now, we're out of here.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely.